The boys ended the ride, as always, with a mad gallop across the polo fields and up the hill to the stables. Sean, riding like a centaur, was far ahead of the rest of them. Michael was too gentle to use the whip, and Garrick bounced awkwardly in the saddle. Despite Shasta's drilling, his seat was atrocious, with toes and elbows sticking out at odd angles. "He rides like a sack of potatoes," Shasta thought with irritation, following them at the sedate pace set by Isabella's portly Shetland on the lead rein. Shasta was an international polo player, and he took his middle son's maladroit seat as a personal affront. Tara was in the kitchens overseeing the last-minute details for dinner when they came trooping in. She looked up and greeted Shasta casually. "Good day." She was wearing those appalling trousers in faded blue denim, which Shasta detested. He liked feminine women. "Not bad," he answered, trying to divest himself of Isabella, who was still wrapped around his neck. He dislodged her and handed her over to Nanny. "We are 12 for dinner," Tara turned her attention back to the Malay chef, who was standing by dutifully. 12? Shasta asked sharply. "I invited the Broadhursts at the last moment."
"Oh, God," Shasta groaned.
"I wanted some stimulating conversation at the table for a change, not just horses and shooting and business. Last time she came to dinner, your and Molly's stimulating conversation broke the party up before 9 o'clock. Shasta glanced at his wristwatch. "I'd better think about dressing." "Daddy, will you feed me?" Isabella called from the children's dining room beyond the kitchen. "You're a big girl, Angel," he answered. "You must learn to feed yourself."
"I can feed myself. I just like it better when you do it. Please, Daddy. Pretty please a trillion times?"
"A trillion?" Shasta asked. "I am bid 1 trillion. Any advance on a trillion?" But he went to her summons. "Ah, you spoil her," Tara said. "She's becoming impossible."
"I know. You keep telling me."
Shasta shaved quickly while his coloured valet laid out his dinner jacket in the dressing room and put the platinum and sapphire studs into his dress shirt. Despite Tara's vehement protests, he always insisted on black tie for dinner. "It's so stuffy and old-fashioned and snobby." "It's civilized," he contradicted her. When he was dressed, he crossed the wide corridor strewn with oriental carpets, the walls hung with a gallery of Thomas Bain's watercolours, tapped on Tara's door, and went into her invitation. Tara had moved into the suite while she was carrying Isabella, and had stayed there. Last year she had redecorated it, removing the velvet drapes and George II and Louis XIV furniture. The Coombe silk carpets and the magnificent oils by de Jong and Naudy, stripping the flocked wallpaper and standing the golden patina off the yellow wood floor until it looked like plain deal. Now the walls were stark white, with only a single enormous painting facing the bed. It was a monstrosity of geometrical shapes in primary colours, in the style of Miro, but executed by an unknown art student at the Cape Town University Art School, and of no value. To Shasta's mind, paintings should be pleasing decorations, but at the same time good long-term investments. This thing was neither. The furniture Tara had chosen for her boudoir was made of an angular stainless steel and glass, and there was very little of it. The bed was almost flat on the bare boards of the floor. "It's Swedish decor," she had explained. "Send it back to Sweden," he had advised her. Now he perched on one of the steel chairs and lit a cigarette. She frowned at him in the mirror. "Oh, forgive me." He stood up and went to flick the cigarette out of the window. "I'll be working late after dinner," he turned back to her, "and I wanted to warn you before I forget that I'm flying up to Joburg tomorrow afternoon, and I'll be away for a few days, maybe 5 or 6. "Fine," she pursed her lips as she applied her lipstick, a pale mauve shade that he disliked intensely. "One other thing, Tara. Lord Littleton's bank is preparing to underwrite the share issue for our possible new development on the Orange Free State goldfields. I would take it as a personal favour if you and Molly could refrain from waving your black sashes in his face and from regaling him with merry tales of white injustice and bloody black revolution." "I can't speak for Molly, but I promise to be good." "Why don't you wear your diamonds tonight?" He changed the subject. "They look so good on you." She hadn't worn the suite of yellow diamonds from the Hany mine since she had joined the sash movement. They made her feel like Marie Antoinette. "Not tonight," she said. "They're a little garish. It's really just a family dinner party." She dusted her nose with the puff and looked at him in the mirror. "Why don't you go down, dear? Your precious Lord Littleton will be arriving at any moment. I just want to tuck Bella up first." He came to stand behind her. They stared at each other in the mirror seriously.
"What happened to us, Tara?" he asked softly.
"I don't know what you mean, dear," she replied. But she looked down and adjusted the front of her dress carefully.
"I'll see you downstairs," he said. "Don't be too long, and do make a fuss of Littleton. He's important, and he likes the girlies."
After he had closed the door, Tara stared at it for a moment. Then she repeated his question aloud.
"What happened to us, Shasa?"
"It's quite simple, really. I just grew up and lost patience with the trivialities with which you fill your life." On the way down, she looked in on the children. Isabella was asleep, with Teddy on top of her face. Tara saved her daughter from suffocating and went to the boys' rooms. Only Michael was still awake. He was reading. "Lights out," she ordered.
"Oh, Mater, just to the end of the chapter."
"Out."
"Just this page."
"Out," I said. And she kissed him lovingly. At the head of the staircase, she drew a deep breath, like a diver on the high board, smiled brightly, and went down into the blue drawing room, where the first guests were already sipping sherry. Lord Littleton was much better value than she had expected. Tall, silver-haired, and benign.
"Do you shoot?" she asked at the first opportunity.
"Can't stand the sight of blood, my dear."
"Do you ride?"
"Horses?" he snorted. "Stupid bloody animals."
"I think you and I are going to be good friends," she said.
There were many rooms in Weltefrieden that Tara disliked. The dining room she actively hated, with all those heads of long-dead animals that Shasa had massacred, staring down from the walls with glass eyes. Tonight she took a chance and seated Molly on the other side of Littleton, and within minutes Molly had him hooting with delighted laughter. When they left the men with the port and Hauptmann's and went through to the ladies' room, Molly pulled Tara aside, bubbling over with excitement.
"I've been dying to get you alone all evening," she whispered. "You'll never guess who's in the Cape at this very moment." "Tell me." "The Secretary of the African National Congress, that's who." "Moses Gama, that's who."
Tara went very still and pale and stared at her.
"He's coming to our home to talk to a small group of us, Tara. I invited him, and he especially asked for you to be present. I didn't know you knew him."
"I met him only once," she corrected herself.
"Twice." "Can you come?" Molly insisted. "It'll be best if Shasa does not know about it, you understand."
"When?"
"Saturday evening, 8 o'clock.
"Shasa will be away and I'll be there," Tara said. "I wouldn't miss it for the world."
Sean Courtney was the stalwart of the Western Province Preparatory School First 15, or Wet Pups, as the school was known. Quick and strong, he ran in 4 tries against the Rondebosch juniors and converted them himself, while his father and 2 younger brothers stood on the touchline and yelled encouragement. After the final whistle blew, Shasa lingered just long enough to congratulate his son, with an effort restraining himself from hugging the sweaty, grinning youngster with grass stains on his white shorts and a graze on one knee. A display like that in front of Sean's peers would have mortified him horribly. Instead, they shook hands.
"Well played, sport. I'm proud of you," he said. "Sorry about this weekend, but I'll make it up to you."
And although the expression of regret was sincere, Shasa felt a buoyancy of his spirits as he drove out to the airfield at Young's Field. Dickie, his Urk, had the aircraft out of the hangar and ready for him on the hard stand. Shasa climbed out of the Jaguar and stood with his hands in his pockets and the cigarette in the corner of his mouth, staring at the sleek machine with rapture. It was a DH-98 Mosquito fighter bomber.
Shasa had bought it at one of the RAF disposal sales at Biggin Hill and had it completely stripped and overhauled by de Havilland trained riggers. He had even had them re-glue the sandwich construction of the wooden bodywork with the new Araldite Wonder Glue. The original Rodux adhesives had proved unreliable under tropical conditions. Stripped of all armaments and military fittings, the Mosquito's already formidable performance had been considerably enhanced. Not even Courtney Mining could afford one of the new civilian jet-engined aircraft, but this was the next best thing. The beautiful machine crouched on the hard stand like a falcon at bait, the twin Rolls-Royce Merlin engines ready to soar into life and hurtle her into the blue. Blue was her colour, sky blue and silver. She shone in the bright Cape sunlight, and on her fuselage, where once the RAF roundel had been, was now emblazoned the Courtney Company logo, a stylized silver diamond, its facets entwined with the company's initials. "How is the port number two magneto?" Shasa demanded of Dicky as he sauntered across in his oily overalls. The little man bridled. "Ticking over like a sewing machine," he answered. He loved the machine even more than Shasa did, and any imperfection, no matter how minor, wounded him deeply. When Shasa reported one, he took it very badly. He helped Shasa load his briefcase, overnight bag, and gun case into the bomb bay, which had been converted into a luggage compartment. "All tanks are full," he said, and stood aside, looking superior, as Shasa insisted on checking them visually, and then made a fuss of his walk-around inspection. "She'll do," Shasa agreed at last, and could not resist stroking the wing, as though it were the limb of a lovely woman. Shasa switched to oxygen at 11,000 feet, and levelled out at Angels 20, grinning into his oxygen mask at the old Air Force slang. He tuned her for cruise, carefully watching the exhaust gas temperatures and engine revs, and then settled back to enjoy it. Enjoy was too mild a term for it. Flying was an exaltation of spirit and a fever in his blood. The immense lion-tawny continent drifted by beneath him, washed by a million suns and burned by the hot, herb-scented Karoo winds, its ancient hide riven and wrinkled and scarred with donga and canyon and dried riverbed. Only up here, high above it, did Shasa truly realize how much he was a part of it, how deep was his love for it. Yet it was a hard land and cruel, and it bred hard men, black and white, and he knew that he was one of them. "There is no place for weaklings here," he thought. "Only the strong can flourish." Perhaps it was the pure oxygen he breathed, enhanced by the ecstasy of flight, but his mind seemed clearer up here. Issues that had been obscure became lucid, uncertainties resolved, and the hours sped away as swiftly as the lovely machine streaked across the blue, so that when he landed at Johannesburg's civilian airport, he knew with certainty what had to be done. David Abrahams was waiting for him, lanky and skinny as ever. But he was balding a little, and he had taken to wearing gold-rimmed spectacles which gave him a perpetually startled expression. Shasa jumped down off the wing of the Mosquito, and they embraced happily. They were closer than brothers. Then David patted the aircraft's wing. "When do I get to fly her again?" he asked wistfully. David had got a DFC in the Western Desert and a bar to it in Italy. He had been credited with 9 kills and ended the war as a wing commander, while Shasa had been a mere squadron leader when he had lost his eye in Abyssinia and been invalided home. "She's too good for you," Shasa told him, and slung his luggage into the back seat of David's Cadillac. As David drove out through the airfield gates, they exchanged family news. David was married to Matilda Janine, Tara Courtney's younger sister, so David and Shasa were brothers-in-law. Shasa boasted about Sean and Isabella without mentioning his other two sons, and then they went on to the real objects of their meeting. These, in order of importance, were, first, the decision whether or not to exercise the option on the new Silver River mining prospect in the Orange Free State. Then there was the trouble with the company's chemical factory on the Natal coast. A local pressure group was kicking up a rumpus about poisoning the seabed and reefs
in the area where the factory was discharging effluent into the sea. And finally, there was David's crazy fixation, from which Shasa was finding it difficult to dislodge him, that they should spend something over £250,000 on one of those new elephantine electric calculators. The Yanks did all the calculations for the atomic bomb with one of them, David argued. And they call them computers, not calculators, he corrected Shasa.
Oh, come on, Davy. What are we going to blow up? Shasa protested. I'm not designing an A-bomb.
Anglo-America have one. It's the wave of the future, Shasa. We'd better be on it. It's £250,000 wave, old son, Shasa pointed out, just when we need every penny for Silver River. If we had had one of these computers to analyze the geological drilling reports from Silver River, we'd have already saved ourselves almost the entire cost of the thing, and we'd be a lot more certain of our final decision than we are now.
Well, how can a machine be better than a human brain?
Just come and have a look at it, David pleaded. The university has just installed an IBM 701. I've arranged a demonstration for you this afternoon.
Okay, Davy, Shasa capitulated.
Look, but that doesn't mean I'm buying. The IBM supervisor in the basement of the engineering faculty building was no more than 26 years of age. They're all kids, David explained. It's a young people's science. The supervisor shook hands with Shasa and then removed her horn-rimmed spectacles. Suddenly, Shasa's interest in electronic computers burgeoned. Her eyes were clear, bright green, and her hair was the colour of wild honey made from mimosa blossom. She wore a green sweater of tight-fitting angora wool and a tartan skirt which left her smooth, tanned calves bare. It was immediately obvious that she was an expert, and she answered all Shasa's questions without hesitation in a tantalising southern drawl. Mary Lee has a master's in electrical engineering from MIT, David murmured, and Shasa's initial attraction was spiced with respect.
It's so damn big, he protested.
It fills the entire basement. The ruddy thing is the size of a four-bedroomed house. Cooling, Mary Lee explained. The heat build-up is enormous. Most of the bulk is oil-cooling baffles. What are you processing at the moment? Professor Dart's archaeological material from the Sterkfontein Caves. We are correlating about 200,000 observations of his against over 1 million from the sites in East Africa.
How long will that take?
We started the run 20 minutes ago. We'll finish it before we shut down at 5 o'clock.
But that's in 15 minutes, Shasa chuckled.
You having me on?
I wouldn't mind, she murmured speculatively. And when she smiled, her mouth was wide and moist and kissable.
You say you shut down at 5, he asked.
When do you start up again?
8 tomorrow morning. And the machine stands idle overnight? Mary Lee glanced down the length of the basement. David was at the other end, watching the printout, and the hum of the computer covered their voices.
That's right. It will stand idle all tonight, just like me.
Clearly she was a lady who knew exactly what she wanted and how to get it. She looked at him directly, challengingly.
Oh, we can't have that, Shasa shook his head seriously. One thing my mummy taught me was waste not, want not. I know a place called the Stardust. The band is far beyond belief. I will wager £1 to a weekend in Paris that I can dance you until you plead for mercy.
It's a bet, she agreed seriously.
But do you cheat?
Of course, he answered. David was coming back, and Shasa went on smoothly and professionally.
What about the running costs?
All in all, including insurance and depreciation, a little under £4,000 a month, she told him, with a matching businesslike expression. As they said goodbye and shook hands, she slipped a card into Shasa's palm.
My address, she murmured.
8 o'clock, he asked.
I'll be there, she agreed.